Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So how did Timothy Geithner do today? The Treasury Secretary hasn't fared well in past public appearances. Today he spoke before the House Financial Services Committee and addressed the anger over the bonuses paid out by taxpayer bailed out AIG.
I share the anger and frustration of the American people, not just about the compensation practice at AIG and in other parts of our system, but that our financial system permitted a scale of risk-taking that has caused grave damage to the lives of so many Americans.
Geithner asked for more government power to seize control of failing non-banks such as AIG, but Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling still wanted to know about those bonuses.
The public needs a straight answer. What did the Obama administration know, and when did they know it? For your plan to succeed, it needs confidence. And for there to be confidence restored, there must be openness, accountability, and honesty.
Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News and author of The Note political blog. So, Rick, did we find out any more about how much and when the administration knew about bonuses?
Not much. And he was pressed on it. Treasury Secretary Geithner was pressed on it a few different ways. But we didn't really learn much new in terms of who knew what and when they knew it. And so far, it looks like Tim Geithner has been able to skate past this little bit of a storm. There's still a lot of anger out there and a lot of outrage and a lot of questioning going on. But the calls for his head seem to have subsided, and it does look like he is going to stay in that post and move on to fight another day.
And just to remind ourselves, there was also thinking that when he was Fed chair in New York, he might have had something to do with designing some of the bailouts of these companies and might have known more even then.
That's exactly right. And he has said he didn't know the full scope of the bailouts until 2 weeks ago when he brought it to then-President Obama's attention a few days later and then tried to get them negotiated down. A lot of folks are still trying to poke holes in that story. But it does look like there doesn't seem to be any big smoking gun that would suggest otherwise.
Well, and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke also spoke today. He told lawmakers that he wanted to sue to stop taxpayer bailed out again. It's taxpayer money at AIG from paying these millions of dollars in employee bonuses. So there's, you know, the threat of a lawsuit to stop it. There, we also know there's a threat of legislation to tax the money back. What's this, you know, this move to claw back, as it's called, these bonuses? How's that move going?
It's very real, although it subsided just over the weekend when President Obama first threw some cold water on it. The Senate is slow-walking the bill, and it may not move for weeks or even months to have the big 90% tax that passed the House last week. Some of the anger has cooled. There's also other efforts afoot to try to recoup the money, and there's been a voluntary effort by a lot of AIG executives to return the money on their own. So all that is having an impact, but the fervor that just lit Capitol Hill on fire last week does seem to have been doused a little bit.
And, you know, I mean, you said that some of the money has voluntarily been given back, but why else would that huge bonfire be almost out?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, I think yesterday the administration tried to get in front of all of this by outlining its new plans for the bank rescue, and there's some more details out today about the new powers that they want to be able to take over failing institutions, not just financial institutions. The fact that the Dow was up yesterday had a lot to do with it, I think.
Yeah.
And I think it also had to do with the way that President Obama handled the outrage that was out there. He acknowledged it and said it was appropriate last week, but he's encouraged people to take a second look at just how you get the money back and is concerned about the Constitution. Precedent that it would set to try to take money back retroactively via the tax code.
Well, and you mentioned the bank bailout plan, which again was unveiled in more detail yesterday. Some investors calling it win-win-win. Wall Street seemed to like it, but New York Times columnist Paul Krugman panned it. It also doesn't include, you know, any restrictions on executive pay, because the thinking is that no banks would sign up to buy up these toxic assets if it did. But, you know, how else is that being viewed today?
Well, look, the issue about executive pay continues to roil a lot of members of Congress, and it's going to be something they have to deal with. But I think there's a general realization that the first step has to be to follow the administration down this path and to see if this plan to try to take the toxic assets off the books works. And if you can get private capital to play along with public money and team up and try to get beyond this, then you're going a long way toward fixing the larger problems in the credit markets. If that doesn't happen and the private folks don't get involved, then I think you'll continue to see more calls for pay caps and limits on executive compensation. So all of this, it's a volatile mix, but it seems like the administration is having a little bit more success selling its message to Congress and beyond than it did last week.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Thanks for helping us dip our toe into the news stream today. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we want to turn to our conversation today with a warning that it will have some strong language and uncomfortable topics that may not be appropriate for children, even though young people are increasingly involved in this topic and their parents may want to listen. Because we're talking about addiction to heroin, alcohol, shoplifting, food, steroids, and sex. How much do these addictions disrupt lives? Well, here is a sex addict who sleeps all morning and then gets to work right after lunch.
1:15. Spend 5 hours online looking for someone attractive to have sex with. Ignore repeated calls from friend with whom I have plans. 6:17 p.m. Call friend, lie about why I can't meet. 6:20. Go back online. Eventually find someone attractive to have sex with. 7:20. Drive an hour to meet the person. Wait. Person doesn't show. 9:40. Get back online. Look for someone new. 10:02. Mom calls. Let it go to voicemail. 10:05. Watch some porn. 10:45. Have phone sex. 12:45 a.m. Remember that I hate phone sex. Resolve to stop having phone sex. 12:46 a.m. Feel shame. 1:08 a.m. Check mom's message. Realize that I forgot her birthday. 1:09 a.m. Feel like killing myself.
And that's a functioning sex addict. In fact, that's Benoit Denise Lewis. He's an award-winning writer. He's contributed to the New York Times, Slate, Sports Illustrated. And he's now written a new book in which he tracks his and eight other addictions. It's called America Anonymous, Eight Addicts in Search of a Life. Benoit joins us in the studio. And, you know, we know that that was tough for you to do that reading. So why do it? Because the whole underpinning of recovery is anonymity. And here you are right up front.
Yeah, well, it's one of the arguments that I make in the book. I mean, we have so much shame around addiction. You know, for years, the millions of Americans who have had successful long-term recovery have been talking to each other, you know, in church basements. One of the results of that is that there has been no advocacy movement around addiction. There have been no people out there saying, you know what, we need to start thinking about this differently.
Someone in your book says, imagine if we had, as the breast cancer survivors do, you know, recovering addicts all dressing in pink and marching on Washington.
Right. And that may be the next step here, because we really need to start rethinking the way that we look at addiction. Addiction is a public health problem. And yet, we don't think about addiction in that way. When's the last time a presidential candidate was asked in a debate what their thoughts were about addiction and recovery? It just never happens.
Right. Well, let's bring in one of the addicts that you follow. He's Jody Pegram. He's the executive director of a Sober Way home in Prescott, Arizona, and a recovering addict with addictions to heroin, crack, prescription drugs, gambling, nicotine. Jody, did I leave anything out?
Probably.
Well, Jody, first, you know, you're very upfront. You give your real name. Most of the addicts in Benoit's book don't. What do you think about Benoit's premise? Well, an anonymity, you know, may help people to get into those rooms in the beginning. It may be cutting down on what we could be doing for addicts because we don't know how many they are and who they are.
Well, it's tough because it's such a balancing act, because anonymity alone, it's a spiritual principle that was never really designed to be this right for privacy, even though that's the way a lot of us in recovery take it. You know, it was really about monitoring our own ego. Mm.
You're saying making sure no one was better than anyone else. Well, Benoit, you take us into a world of addiction that's far deeper than many may have known about. Janice is a crack-addicted grandmother. Then there's Todd, married to a woman. He has body dysmorphia, which means he can't really see his body for what it is, which is huge. He's become a bodybuilder, addicted to steroids. He pays for the steroids by prostituting himself to men who are attracted specifically to overly muscular bodybuilders. Then there's also Kate, a young mom who's addicted to shoplifting. Ellen, a food addict who ate enough for a family of three. Sean, a college-age sex addict. But, you know, I can hear people saying, wait a minute, crack, I understand, but sex, is that really an addiction?
There was a real division 5 or 10 years ago. A lot of researchers and scientists who studied addiction said, you know what, drugs and alcohol, those are addictions. But, you know, these things like sex and overeating, we can't call these things addictions because there's no substance being ingested. Now, the more we look inside the brains of sex addicts and gamblers and food addicts, they're seeing real similarities to the brains of drug addicts and alcoholics.
Well, for now, sex addiction is not listed as a disorder in the main manual used by mental health professionals. But you spoke with addiction expert Patrick Carnes, who said, you know, he thinks that more and more teens in particular could be called sex addicts. Why?
The internet. The internet has really turned a lot of people who did not really struggle with sex addiction so much into sex addicts. I mean, I wrote a piece in the New York Times writing about my own addiction. The hundreds of emails that I got from some women, mostly men all across the country, husbands who couldn't stop sneaking away while their wife was asleep to go into the den and couldn't stop looking at pornography and said, why can't I stop this? I'm so able to, you know, be successful and to control myself in all other areas of my life. I feel like I have an addiction to this. The internet is really changing things.
Well, you need to say, I mean, here's Sean, this young kid. Someone said to him he'd get addicted, you know, he'd become a sex addict, I'm trying to remember, and he said, wow, wouldn't that be great? He thought, well, that would be great. What would be wrong with that? How horrible is it? Because it's horrible for him and for you.
Yeah.
How horrible is it?
It's, you know, it's interesting. I'll tell some people, it tends to be married heterosexual men, I'll say, you know, I'm a sex addict. And they say, well, if we could all be so lucky, yeah, you know, that yeah, we can be having all this sex. And sex addiction, like any addiction, is completely debilitating. It turns me into a person who is incredibly selfish. It blocks virtually all the good from coming out of me because I'm spending so much time in this pursuit of this one thing, which invariably makes me miserable. You know, I can pretend like everything's okay. I tend to get my work done on time, so I can pass. You know, there are some drug addicts who really can't. You know, for Janice, she was on the street living in crack houses. I can pass as being okay. But inside, I'm dead.
Right. And it's so hard to get away from it. Sean, this young kid you profile who bounces from recovery to recovery, you know, he can't even buy a cell phone that doesn't have internet access when he wants to keep himself from...
Right, he has to go through a lot of hoops, and I've had that same thing, go through a lot of hoops to find a cell phone without internet access so he can't look at online
right.
porn.
Well, let's bring Jody back in, again, executive director of A Sober Way Home in Prescott, Arizona, and a recovering addict himself. You know, Jody, while people debate what addiction is, you seem to have a pretty simple way of describing. In your mind, what's an addiction?
What I look at is the quality of your life. And if it's negative, is it a result of, you know, a substance, the sex, the gambling, the eating? And if that's the case and you've tried to, you know, correct it by not doing it with failure, you need some help. If you want to call it an addiction, if you want to call it a disease, it really doesn't matter.
Well, and as you know, it matters to other people, especially when it comes to sex addiction. That's the most controversial because addiction experts in fields like alcohol and drugs worry that if there is a sex addiction disorder, it'll hamper their goal of making their fields, you know, accepted as diseases. And victims' rights advocates worry that an official sex addiction disorder could be used by sex offenders or philandering men to escape punishment or criticism. We've been talking to Jody Pegram, an executive director of the Sober Way Home in Prescott, Arizona, and Benoit Denizet-Lewis, talking about addiction. Benoit's new book is America Anonymous, 8 Addicts in Search of a Life. We'll come back with them. Later today, also, the Exxon Valdez spill 20 years on, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking today about addiction with Benoit Denizet-Lewis, author of America Anonymous, 8 Addicts in Search of a Life. We're also joined by Jody Pegram, executive director of A Sober Way Home in Prescott, Arizona. And Jody, let's start with you because your story speaks to how fragile recovery is. At one point, you were sober. You founded a sober living community called CARE. Then you met an addiction psychiatrist who wanted to address what everyone thought was an attention deficit disorder. And he wanted to have you take Adderall. He told you it wasn't addictive. But what happened?
I got addicted. You know, it is addictive, and everybody knows that now.
It happened to you again after another stretch of recovery when you had excruciating pain, which turned out to be kidney stones. How frightened were you at that point to take the medication that you needed to take?
You know, I was terrified. You know, you're always a step away or a pill away or, you know, whatever it is away from a really waking up that lion, if you will.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, I was following Jody through the kidney stones, and Jody was really scared. And I think Jody's story is so fascinating on a number of levels. One, both Jody and Bobby, who's a heroin addict in South Boston, and his brother is actually addicted to OxyContin. Through both of their stories, I'm able to explore a little bit an important new trend, and that's prescription drugs. I mean, illegal drugs in this country continue to decline. We're actually using fewer illegal drugs. Well, people have just replaced that with prescription drugs. I mean, if we really want a war on drugs, it should be a war on prescription drug abuse. It's skyrocketing.
Well, you know, speaking about prescription medication, Jody, Benoit also explores this debate about which is the better for recovery, the new medications that are coming along that help addicts curb their desire for alcohol and drugs, or straight AA support groups therapies, you know, no meds recoveries. Your thoughts on that?
It's really about working in concert with, you know, the 12-step movement, if there's some medications that can help with cravings. And as you start to bring it all together, you're really going to ultimately get the most effective result.
Yeah, and the pharmaceutical industry right now is really excited by the prospect of whether they can do for addiction what they did for depression. I really throw a little caution to the wind here that you know, science has been about to save us from addiction for the last 200 years. I mean, we've always been making progress, and there are those who claim that we're this close to really understanding what's going on in the brain, and if you take this pill, this is the magic bullet. So, you know, while all of this science is very exciting and it may really change the way we treat addiction, we're not there yet.
Well, meanwhile, Benoit, as we get to the end of your book, you begin to ask, you know, what am I doing? Here you are, an addict, climbing into eight other addicts' heads, and you start to wonder why you're going near these things that are such triggers for you. But it does seem as if one thing you all get out of your reporting is the friendship. So, Jody, back to this idea of getting rid of anonymity. Do you agree with Benoit's call to stand shoulder to shoulder and step up and claim this illness?
You know, I don't want to do anything against the 12-step programs. They're great. They are the foundation of recovery. They saved my life. At the same time, I really wish more people would step up and say, look, this is my story. Because for me to be an addict, to get well, there's something I have to do. I have to admit there's a problem. And in order for this country to really have major changes, it's going to have to do the same thing.
Well, and Benoit, you may not get the million-person march that you're hoping for, but you do have actor David Duchovny admitting to sex addiction. There have been people admitting to shoplifting addictions. And even if you have a march calling for more research and rehab places, it won't change a factor you say you found. You say you can trace the problems of addicts to childhood abuse. Jody's dad was an alcoholic who left the family. But, Benoit, you didn't seem to find that in your family.
It's complicated with me. I adore both of my parents now, and they're two of my best friends. I grew up with a mother who never once said she loved me, never hugged me. I grew up feeling incredibly alone. And now this is not to say, because everyone says, oh, you're blaming your parents. There are plenty of people who don't feel love from their parents who don't grow up to become addicts. So I'm not saying that there's a definite, that happened, my mom didn't do this, and suddenly I'm an addict. But it's clear when we look at addicts and you look at the eight people that I wrote about in my book, seven of them had serious trauma growing up, whether that was sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional neglect, parents who were unrecovered addicts. The role of childhood abuse and trauma on any level throughout one's lifetime is critical. And a lot of times we sort of skip over that, and because it's sort of seen as an excuse if you're talking about that, well, you're blaming your past, just move on. It's not about blaming our past. It's about honestly looking at whatever happened to us and trying to heal that. Because if that remains unhealed and unlooked at, it's going to pop into your life in different ways, right, in different negative ways.
We also should mention young gay people. You speak to an expert who reminds us that imagine if heterosexual children were forced to date and go to the prom with people of the same sex, which is essentially what happens to young gay boys and girls. They're forced to interact with people they don't want to interact with.
And, well, interact in that way.
When they're sort of hiding their sexuality.
I mean, we know that rates of substance abuse are higher among young gay men than among young heterosexuals. And this we can clearly look at as trauma. It's still, for many people, inherently traumatic to grow up. You know, what do you learn as a gay kid growing up in this culture? You learn compartmentalization. You learn how to lie. You learn how to pass. You learn that you can't trust other people with the truest of who you are. So we do see higher rates of substance abuse. Fortunately, as this country and the world becomes less homophobic and more accepting, I think that's going to change.
Benoit Denizet-Lewis, his book is America Anonymous, Eight Addicts in Search of a Life. Jody Pegram, who's the executive director of A Sober Way Home in Prescott, Arizona, one of the addicts, one of the recovering addicts that Benoit follows. Jody's been joining us as well. Jody, Benoit, I want to thank you both.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, veteran BBC correspondent Lise Doucette will have her view of Afghanistan. And later today, HBO's newest offering. It borrows from a beloved book series. You're listening to Here and Now. We've fetched up hard aground. With those words 20 years ago today, Captain Joe Hazelwood alerted the Coast Guard that his ship, the Exxon Valdez, had hit Bligh Reef in Prince William Sound, Alaska, triggering one of the worst environmental disasters ever. 11 million gallons of crude oil spilled over 1,300 miles of coastline, devastating wildlife, but also ultimately changing the way oil is shipped. Mike Carey is a columnist with the Anchorage Daily News. Mike, welcome back to Here and Now, and help us with a review on where we stand today. Let's start with wildlife. Have all the species rebounded?
Since the spill, we've had a certain amount of dueling science as experts have gone into Prince William Sound and areas nearby to measure the damage to wildlife and sea life. From what I understand, seabirds and sea mammals have rebounded, and we do know that the profitable salmon industry has done well in the last number of years, at least in catches. There has been a decline in herring, and there seems to be a decline in the whales as well as the orcas, and I know some of the scientists who've been involved in that, and there's a great discussion of why that might be.
Well, where are we in litigation? Exxon paid out at least $1 billion to cover the cleanup cost, another $500 million in punitive damages to Alaskan residents affected by the spill. But is there any more, you know, still lingering?
Well, there's a famous curse. May you be right in a lawsuit. And we saw that played out in the Exxon Valdez litigation, which lasted years and years, where plaintiffs were trying to get Exxon to pay them various forms of compensation. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and just this last year was settled. Now there's some indication the federal government's going to go ask Exxon for more money for unanticipated research and other activities. But we don't know how that's going to play out. We know Exxon's going to resist being asked to pay any more money. They're pretty firm in taking the line that we've spent billions, and we don't want to spend billions more.
Right. Well, that could end up in court. But meanwhile, this has all changed the way oil is now shipped. In 1990, Congress passed the Oil Pollution Act, one of the provisions that all tankers in U.S. waters be double-hulled by 2015. We understand most shippers have already made that switch. We understand there's a much better tugboat escort. But Bill Woody, who was the National Transportation Safety Board's lead investigator on the Exxon case and at 80 is still an investigator, said recently that, you know, really it boils down to people. All it takes is one person like Captain Hazelwood, who was reportedly drinking when the ship ran aground. It just takes one person to have an accident like this. Do people in Alaska feel safe?
The Anchorage Daily News reports out of the tankers that are in Prince William Sound now, only one does not have a double hull, and that would be an improvement. The Daily News also reports, and I think this is really important for your listeners, that in 2008 there were only 284 tanker trips, whereas 20 years ago the number was 900. That is in a year. And the point of that is there's less oil that's being delivered from the North Slope to Valdez, so there's less oil to transport. So if you have less tanker trips, I mean, in that sense, you're going to have a less chance of an accident.
Right. And the Valdez spill, we remember, you know, pretty much killed a move in Congress back then, 20 years ago, to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling. I just want to ask you, though, about how people in Alaska view all this. Joe Hazelwood, again, the captain, recently, for the first time, said, you know, apologized to the people of Alaska for the damage he caused. Did that resonate there, or have people moved on, or what's?
If there is such a thing as Christian forgiveness in this world, it's probably time to forgive Joe Hazelwood. He had to do a certain penance by coming up here and doing community service, and the idea of the captain of the Exxon Valdez picking up garbage as a form of penance. I think most people feel Hazelwood personally has paid the price. There's still a feeling here that among some people, especially in coastal communities, that Exxon got off too easy, and there is still a belief among some people, especially in coastal communities, that the oil spill was much bigger, much more damaging, and much more profound than the government, Exxon, or anybody else has let on.
Can you still find pieces of the oil?
A couple of years ago, I did find something that came up on a beach in Homer, but not recently. And I should add, what an amazing experience it was. I was a newspaper editor at that time, and I went to the spill, and just the smell of oil, raw oil, in this pristine environment was a remarkable, unforgettable, and painful experience.
Michael Carey, columnist with the Anchorage Daily News. He also hosts the public television program Anchorage Edition. Mike, thanks as always.
Great to be here.
And by the way, we know a lot of you listeners out there are nodding as well. We want to welcome new listeners in KUAC, 89.9 FM in Fairbanks, Alaska. It's Here and Now. Welcome back. Payday loans are those small, short-term loans with incredible interest rates that, in theory, are supposed to tide people over till payday. That's a theory. Now, there were fewer than 200 payday lending stores in the U.S. in the early 1990s, but now payday stores outnumber McDonald's. There are over 22,000, serving 10 million homes every year. It's a $40 billion industry, all around the idea of a bad check. You write a check that you know you can't cover, and then for a $30 fee, the lender pays you for that bad check, holds on to it, until you pay them back on payday. But the trick is most people can't pay the whole amount, the check plus the fee, on payday, and each period they don't pay, they owe another fee. Well, where did this practice begin? Daniel Brook writes in April's Harper's Magazine about Johnson City, Tennessee, which claims to be the birthplace of payday lending. Dan joins us from NPR's New York Bureau. And Daniel, you met a man named James Eaton. Now, there's a sign above his gas station turned payday lending store that says, here's where it all started, East Tennessee, first, oldest, and finest. He claims to be the guy who started it all. What did you see there?
Well, I sat down on a church pew he'd brought in from his wife's childhood church in Alabama. Every so often, a customer would come in. They were quite varied in age and race. What I was observing happening was this cycle of debt. I mean, the number of people who were there as first-time customers was very small. The number of people who were there as repeat customers, he would greet them very warmly. They would greet him less warmly. And then they would write their check and take their money and go on their way.
So they're paying and paying and paying. Well, Eaton knew a man named Alan Jones who heard about his idea of payday lending, and he is the first to take it national. He started Check Into Cash in Tennessee. It's now the third largest of its kind in the country with 1,200 stores in 32 states. It's estimated Alan Jones has amassed a fortune of $500 million. Tell us more about Alan Jones. Who is he?
Alan Jones is a payday lending kingpin. I see him sort of like Ray Kroc, the man who started the McDonald's chain. He didn't found McDonald's. Those were the McDonald's brothers in Southern California. But Ray Kroc was the one who saw that it could be a giant national chain. So Alan Jones is essentially the Ray Kroc of payday lending.
You go to a Check Into Cash in Tennessee. You spend some time there talking to people. For instance, Susan Jolliffe. Why was she needing to go to payday lending?
Like a lot of people who take out payday loans. What precipitated it was a small crisis that for someone with a job making under $9 an hour is a giant crisis. She had her wallet stolen. That wallet had the remainder of her stimulus package refund check in it, about $175 in cash. And that $175 was the difference between being in the black and being in the red. That's what sent her to Check Into Cash. By the time I caught up with Ms. Jolliffe, she'd already had the loan out for 3 months, but had not been able to pay back that $175 principal plus the fee to get out from under it, even though she had already paid Check Into Cash over $175.
Well, and she told you that the people in the store were as nice as can be, but you learned that this is actually, you know, part of the way they operate.
That's correct. I met with a former store manager from Check & Go, which is one of the main competitors of Check Into Cash, and he walked me through the manager training where they said your repeat customer is your lifeblood because that's how the company makes its money. Of course, if people were paying their loans back promptly after they took it out, the company would not make much money. So they cultivate these chummy relationships where the store manager will ask after the customer's families. Of course, the transaction becomes less and less cheerful as time goes on and the person becomes more and more trapped in debt.
Right. You're right. Sometimes customers, to save face, will take out a payday loan from another payday lender to pay off the first just because it's gotten so embarrassing they're going back so many times.
And embarrassment's a really fascinating component to all this. The company Check Into Cash, their slogan is quick, easy, and confidential. And the confidentiality, I think, is a big part of what sucks people in because rather than having to talk to, say, your landlord and saying, look, I can't pay my full $750 rent. It's embarrassing. You lose face. So instead, you take what seems to be an easy way out by getting a payday loan. Only later, when you fall into this debt trap, do you realize it's actually much easier to talk to a creditor in the first place rather than to try to take this way out.
Right. But why, Daniel, isn't this usury, an unlawful rate of interest? Why isn't this against the law?
Well, Robin, I would say it is usury. The problem is that usury is no longer illegal in this country. As Thomas Gagin, the Chicago labor lawyer, says in his companion piece in this April issue of Harper's, the usury law has basically been repealed in this country through a number of legislative and court decisions, starting with the Marquette decision at the Supreme Court in 1978, which ruled that a credit card can carry the rate of interest that is legal in the state where the bank is headquartered, usually a state like Delaware that has no cap on interest rates. So essentially, all of our interest rate regulations have been dismantled, and that's how we're left with an industry like payday lending.
Well, we should say that payday loan laws vary state to state. About a dozen states have some laws that, in effect, ban them. But you visited Alan Jones in his hometown of Cleveland, Tennessee, where his company, Check Into Cash, is based. And he sees nothing wrong with it. He sees himself as a philanthropist. He donated the library building. The Jones Wrestling Center at Cleveland High School is named after him. What do, you know, Jones and his people say about this?
The president of the company said when I asked him about why people often get into this cycle of debt, he says, I don't pretend to understand how our customers think. The way the company executives defend payday lending is by saying that it's a niche product for people in a certain time in their life and a certain jam, and it should be available to them. Their main line of defense is that compared to the other options, this is not such a bad one. When you look at what a bounced check fee costs, of course, the bounced check fee is a one-time fee. So I found it a rather self-serving argument.
Well, in fact, you write that payday lending, in your mind, is the 21st century equivalent of sharecropping, indentured servitude.
The arguments you get are very similar to the arguments that once were used to defend sharecropping. The landholders or the defenders of sharecropping would say, well, here we are with a lot of people with no land and no money. So if they're going to be able to be productive members of society, if they're going to be able to farm, we have to have people who do have land and do have money, advance them money to buy tools and seeds and let them rent some land that they can farm. And if they weren't better off by signing these sharecropping contracts, they wouldn't sign them. Well, in the same way today, we do have all of these people who are strapped, who do have a $20 copay at the pediatrician and it sends them into the red. Well, why don't we think of it in the broader context of why are there so many people for whom a $20 unexpected expense puts them into the red? I note in the article that the minimum wage in the United States, adjusted for inflation, peaked in 1968. Well, if the minimum wage peaked 40 years ago, the number of people who are making inadequate amount of money to make ends meet is going to be enormous. And that's the population that takes out these payday loans.
And just a reminder, you're not talking about check cashing services. This is
no.
A payday loan. And therefore, these are people with paychecks, with checking accounts.
That's what I find so scary about this whole concept. Anyone who takes out a payday loan has to have a bank account. Anyone who's unemployed can't take out a payday loan. So the target market for this is, I guess, what we would call the lower middle class.
And what, in fact, the industry calls the 44s. It's based on a Nielsen breakdown of American consumers. These are the 44s, homespun families, part of the mass middle class.
Yes, unfortunately, that's accurate. The mass middle class does, at this point, live paycheck to paycheck, has unreliable health care, has often unreliable transportation. This is the target market for the company Check Into Cash and its competitors.
Daniel, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
The number one ladies detective agency is one of the most successful and beloved mystery book series. They're written by Alexander McCall Smith, who was born in Zimbabwe and worked in Botswana, where the series is set, and where Detective Precious Ramotswe goes about solving crimes in between not infrequent breaks for tea. Because as Alexander McCall Smith told us a while ago, his Precious loves her tea.
I love the tea scenes. I ration myself to about 3 tea scenes per book.
Well, this Sunday, HBO premieres a new series based on the number one ladies detective agency. It stars Grammy-winning singer Jill Scott as Precious Ramotswe. Here in Us Critic-at-Large, Ed Siegel has a preview.
I like my mysteries like my coffee, dark. But Alexander McCall Smith has hooked me with his light, infectious tales of Detective Precious Ramotswe. Her powers of logic are matched by an earthy humanism that covers the Botswana landscape with a glow as warm as the African sun. Just listen to the way she inverts English expressions like, there's something fishy going on here.
Lucky Sasana. This is his lawyer.
Sasana, yes. This is the man.
Is it? Now I'm getting a slight smell of fish in my nostrils.
The narrative Smith establishes, and the way he matter-of-factly moves Precious through her paces, makes you want to put on some township jazz, brew some of her favorite rosebush tea, and settle in for an evening's worth of storytelling. It was only a matter of time before the number one ladies detective agency was made into a TV series. The stars aligned when HBO, the Weinstein Company, and the BBC announced their collaboration. Among the executive producers were such high-powered names as the late Anthony Minghella, who directed the pilot with his big-screen virtues intact. It's just sumptuously filmed. Few directors catch the sense of place like Minghella. Egypt in The English Patient, Italy in The Talented Mr. Ripley, and now Southern Africa. We're so used to American television landscapes that it's a delight to have someone take us to another world. And Minghella captures both the beauty and the poverty of Botswana. Take this scene in which Precious investigates religious sects that cater to and sometimes prey on Africa's poor as she looks for a missing person. Here she talks to the bishop of one of those churches.
Have you come to be healed?
Oh, no. I'm in very good health, thank you.
You might.
Particularly my teeth. But I do have a question. Does the name Peter Simpambe mean anything to you?
Why do you ask?
Because he's disappeared, and the only clue I've got is that he belonged to an apostolic church.
You think he's gone off with some young female fellow Christians? Well, sometimes, unfortunately, man falls prey to the temptations of the flesh.
That is one possibility.
Well, he's not a member of my flock. The apostolic church of the Holy Spirit believes in marriage for life.
Minghella's soundtrack is impeccable, too. Jill Scott plays Precious, and here she does double duty singing at her father's funeral. But the number one ladies detective agency also highlights Minghella's flaws. He was attracted to literary subjects, but I don't think he ever captured the essence of the novelists he adapted. He missed the poetry of Michael Ondaatje's The English Patient. The Talented Mr. Ripley was on the right track, but having Matt Damon's Ripley break down in tears at the end completely subverted Patricia Highsmith's artfulness. In the number one ladies detective agency, Minghella and screenwriter Richard Curtis take the simplicity of Alexander McCall Smith's prose and make it, well, simple-minded. If ever you wanted an example of someone being too cute by half, here's Precious interviewing a prospective client named Happy Babetsi.
What kind of parents you had calling you happy? Imagine if they called you miserable.
Yes, that would not have been good.
Or ugly. Imagine if every time someone said, are you ugly? You would have to say, yes, I am.
Yes, or if they had called me fat, then I would always have to say, yes, it is me. I am fat, for example.
The tone is silly when compared even to the audiobook version narrated by Lisette Lacaux, which captures Smith's tone, playful but sophisticated.
Ma Ramotswe watched her client as she sipped her bush tea. Everything you wanted to know about a person was written in the face, she believed. And the eyes, of course. They were very important. The eyes allowed you to see right into a person, to penetrate their very essence. And that was why people with something to hide wore sunglasses indoors. They were the ones you had to watch very carefully.
Precious is also a much better and more successful detective than the HBO series lets on. So if you're looking for African atmospherics, the number one ladies' detective agency couldn't be better looking or better sounding. But if you're looking for it to capture the tone of Alexander McCall Smith, the series is not number one in my book.
The number one ladies' detective agency premieres this Sunday on HBO. Ed Siegel is Here and Now's critic at large.